don't be pigeonholed as the Christian guy. You know, at the same time, it is absolutely central to who I am.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Profile. This week with me, Esther Higham. The Profile is brought to you by Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. And it's a chance to hear from a leading Christian to find out a little bit more about them, their work, and of course, their faith. Today I'm speaking with David Smith, MP. David spent more than 20 years working for Christian charities such as Tear Fund, the Bible Society and Oasis Housing. But after feeling a strong call to politics, he became the Labour MP for North Northumberland in July 2024. Just months after that, he was given the role of Special Envoy for Freedom of Religion or Belief, becoming the government's champion for religious freedom around the world. In our conversation, we spoke about the problems that politics can fix, the role that Christians can play in Parliament, and his own faith journey, which started when he was just 4 years old. So David Smith, MP, great to meet you. You became an MP about 15 months ago now in July 2024. First time MP, first time Labour MP for the ward that you represent, a new ward as well, I believe. But what's the first year been like for you? What have been the highs and lows?
How long do you have, Esther? Because it's not a simple it's not a simple answer. I suppose I could try and abridge it by saying it's been the most intense, interesting, challenging, exciting year of my life in a work context. You know, the learning curve is not a curve; it's a vertical takeoff. Really, I think if for any MP, when you start, it's like starting a small business, or you know, you can use all kinds of metaphors. The one that's quite good is building the plane as the plane is flying. You know. Because at the end of the day, you have to establish an office, you have to learn a new job, you have to hire people, you have to understand how Parliament works in terms of the protocol and the processes and the cycle of that. So there's just a huge volume to take on, and then you're doing all of that in the public eye. So yeah, it's intense.
And it's quite rare for someone in our position in life, you've been a senior leader in charities, to start something new and be the new boy again. Did you have any wobbly moments?
Well, absolutely, yes, loads of wobbly moments, and people remind me of my wobbly moments. But yes, I have. The nice thing is that in this turn, you know, this was the Parliament, and starting in 24, that has had the highest turnover of any Parliament pretty much in history in terms of the number of new MPs. So I've got very good company across the party, the parties in Parliament, but obviously especially in the Labour Party. So I've had lots and lots of colleagues in exactly the same situation as me. So that's been quite good.
Why Labour? Why are you a Labour MP?
Oh, that's a great question. It is where I am most politically at home and always has been. And I think that's partly to do with upbringing and the role that the Labour Party had both in intergenerationally in my family. I mean, going back as far as my grandparents, maybe even beyond that, certainly in my life as I was growing up, benefiting as a teen, well, young man really, under the Labour government starting in 1997 and the direct benefit that I saw. But I think there definitely are deeper philosophical, maybe even theological reasons. That's not to make any claim about, you know, the Labour Party over any other party from the perspective of being a Christian, because I know and love and respect other, you know, Christian friends who are involved in other political parties or members of Parliament for other political parties. But it fits with me, like everything I've done in my life, it just fits with me in a way that I say, yeah, that's my home.
Go on, give me one example, perhaps, of one of the theological reasons, if you want to be that grand, about why Labour fits you.
Okay, you know, in a nutshell, the teachings of Jesus chime I think with me as a Christian, in a way that is about the other and how we welcome the stranger and the other, how we prioritize those that have the least, those that are most vulnerable. And I do see in the history of the Labour Party, which has made many mistakes over many years, so it's you know, but that's a driving factor within the labour movement, is to seek to advance the interest of the least amongst us, and so that for me is a it chimes hugely as a Christian.
So is it a bit frustrating then, as a backbench MP, although you have another role as the Special Envoy for Freedom of Religion and Belief? We'll come to that shortly as well. But as a backbench MP committed to grassroots, how does it feel then when you see the struggles that Labour leadership are having at the moment, with landing some of those ideas that you care about? Because it seems like they've got caught up in having to defend lots of other things. Are people in your area thinking, great, Labour is in government, they're going to represent the needs of the least? How do you feel about that connection between local Labour activism and your constituency and what's happening in Westminster?
I'm the first ever Labour MP for North Northumberland. Well, it's a new constituency, but the vast majority of it was a pre-existing Berwick-upon-Tweed constituency, and I'd never have had a Labour Member of Parliament in history, as in a couple of hundred years. So, you know, there was a clear demand at the last general election for change, and my constituents, I think, definitely do believe that you know, the Labour Party and me as their Labour MP is the you know, vehicle for that. That being said, you know, it's always very, very difficult for any government to get traction and turn things around as quickly as we would all like to see things turn around, and without getting too political about it, you know. I don't think many people would disagree that we had an absolutely terrible inheritance from, you know, when we were elected, you know, the position that the country was in. So, yeah, it's a huge task, and realistically, that task has only just begun. Even although we're sort of 14 months, 15 months in, and you know, I certainly and the party during the opposition period and during the general election, and me personally, were straight up with people and said that, you know, to turn things around, it's not going to happen in 6 months. It's not going to happen in a year. It might not even happen in this parliament. It might take a decade. And I think that's the truth, and it's the hard truth that sometimes it's difficult to say and take ownership of as a politician. But I think it is the truth.
You told our mutual friend and my colleague and your colleague, Tim Farron, recently that one of the reasons that you decided to become an MP is because after your work for various Christian charities, you realised there were some problems that can only be fixed by politics. What are the problems that you're trying to fix now in your role as an MP?
Well, as an MP, you start to find your groove about, you know, what difference can you make? Someone asked me the other day, you know, how do you cover all the bases that you have to cover? And the simple fact is, you can't. No human being can. I mean, if you look at my or any MP's inbox, you can have anything from protect red squirrels to sort out the situation in Gaza, you know, and obviously, that's why party, you know, politics has formed into parties, because individuals can't do everything. There's a degree of collective responsibility, so you share that together. But then you find your own groove of the things that you're passionate about or have experience of it, expertise in. For me, that has shaped the things that I am now doing in Parliament. One of those would be homelessness, which is what I was doing just before I came into Parliament as Chief Executive of Homelessness Charity. So I'm the Vice Chair of the Labour Party Group and very involved with, you know, hopefully trying to help the government have the tools to do what it needs to do in order to address homelessness. Another would be Northern Ireland. I sit in the Select Committee for that because, you know, I spent my first proper job was setting up and running a peacemaking programme in Northern Ireland, and I really am passionate about Northern Ireland. Another one is which was more of a surprise to me, but which chimes a lot with my experience in the background, is to become the UK Special Envoy for Freedom of Religion or Belief. So you take what you're passionate about, you take what you know, and you feel you have something to offer, and that's where you then try to add something to the collective whole.
Let's take homelessness. What could change? What needs to change in politics to begin to address the issue of homelessness?
Yeah. So I just to give a bit of context, I'd spent 8 years as chief exec of a homelessness charity in the northeast and operating in the northeast in London. That's what I was doing immediately before I became an MP. And we've seen over, if you look at the last 20, 30 years, to give a bit of context, we've seen times when homelessness spiked. And I don't just mean rough sleeping, although I include that. Rough sleeping, temporary accommodation. The inability to have and maintain a home with all the different forms of homelessness. So that spiked at times and it's then got under control. And the first thing to say is that there is an act of political will that is necessary to focus on it, to prioritise it, to take a comprehensive view on it. And we've seen at times, like under the last Labour government in the early part of this century, when Baroness Louise Casey headed up the rough sleeping unit and had huge success in almost eradicating rough sleeping. We saw, and I was part of this during the pandemic, COVID, we had the Everyone In programme, and that got about 37,000 people accommodated and off the street. But there has to be the sustained political will to address the problem, and that is multiple different dimensions, which is why the government's working on, hopefully will publish soon, the cross-government homelessness strategy. And that's really, really important, because that's not been done well, really ever, in terms of homelessness as a whole, because homelessness has so many different dimensions to it. It's about, how do we have enough housing? Do we have enough support for people that have complex issues in their life, whether it's mental health or substance abuse, etc.? Jobs, pay, all these different things. The health system, how does that work? All these things fit together. So all of that's to say, there's no one big lever you can pull, but if you have a sustained, resourced approach to homelessness, it can be solved.
I look forward to seeing that strategy come forth as well. Let's take you back to the things that drive you, David, and your personal faith. You were brought up in a Christian home, and you had an experience of God quite early on. Tell me about that.
I'm laughing at this because it's not the sort of conversation I'm quite happy to talk about, but it's not the conversation that you tend to have in my day-to-day political life. And it's probably worth saying that, I came into politics thinking, don't be pigeonholed as the Christian guy, because I've never really wanted to be pigeonholed, but at the same time, it is absolutely central to who I am. And yeah, I think you have to be. You have to have that authenticity, otherwise, you could do damage to yourself, I think. So yeah, I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian since I was a very young boy, about 4, when I made a simple confession of faith. A real, yeah, I remember the moment sitting with a friend who's still a friend today, and just felt, well, yeah. I need to get myself right with God, which you can think as a 4-year-old. I mean, how bad could it have gone wrong at that point? But sometimes I've met some amazing people over my life who've had incredible testimonies of traumatic Damascus Road moments, and I think that's wonderful. But for me, it was just a sudden sense and an ongoing sense since that God is real. Jesus is real, that we were made to have a relationship with him, and that I wanted that.
Well, I can chime with that because I had a similar experience at 6 years old, and I know how profound that can be for even a very young child. So, did you have a wild teenage years where you left it all behind for a while?
No, not really. I don't even have that. I mean, I don't know whether, for me, it's significant, I think, for me that I lost my dad when I was just turned 16, and suddenly and overnight. And you hinted that I was brought up in a Christian home, and the pattern and of being involved in church and of my parents' faith was a huge contributor to me becoming a Christian, because I saw in them the real lived foundational element that their faith had in their life, that it wasn't a badge or a Sunday thing. You know, it was real to them, and I saw that in it. So when I lost my dad, I think that, you know, that's the point when a lot of, you know, I was six, just turned 16, and a lot of, you know, people, that's when they would sort of go off the rails or whatever. But for me at that point, that was obviously a crisis. And that was a, there was a profound sense of being held by God. And I just don't think, you know, when you've had been through that, and you can't deny that thereafter, you know. So I, for me, I've not had a big rebellion, but I think I'd like to think that I've always tested my faith, intellectually,
Well, that is a
and another.
huge test to your faith, though. You know, what you went through losing your dad at 16, that in itself is a huge challenge to God. Are you there?
Yeah, it was. It was. And you ask deeper questions of God and of, you know, the adults as it was around you at that time. And I did, and I have. But I think, you know, I, to be honest, I always grew up in a, in the family where we were encouraged to ask tough questions anyway. So it wasn't like suddenly you're confronted with tragedy and then you have to start asking the hard questions. That, you know, we'd always been encouraged by my parents, by the church I was part of, you know, search these things out, ask the questions, think it through. And as well, I was surrounded by, because my parents were very interested and involved in Christian mission, especially to what was then the, had been the communist world, the Soviet bloc. I'd met lots of people from a very young age that had had to make decisions about their faith, that cost them, whether it be imprisonment or torture or persecution or discrimination of different types. So I'd seen that from a very, very early age, and I knew that, you know, you have to make a choice at some point.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
When did you start to join the dots between what you felt God was doing in your own life? You're joining the dots between a personal faith and it actually making a difference to the wider world. I guess meeting these people must have been part of that, but did you have a moment when those dots joined, or was it a growing realization that as a Christian you could do something to make a difference?
Yeah, a growing realization over my whole, well, my whole life, actually. It didn't just arbitrarily stop at some point, you know, it's continued. But certainly throughout my youth and young adulthood, I mean, meeting people like Richard Wurmbrand and Brother Andrew and people, and many others that aren't as famous as those men who had suffered because of their faith, severely suffered because of their faith, and given their life to, you know, that greater calling. That was profound. But also, even just in simple ways, you know, meeting people in the days before EasyJet, meeting people from all over the world all the time, you know, meeting people from sub-Saharan Africa and Asia and South America and other parts of Europe, coming to me in the west of Scotland, and, you know, as a young boy, that was really influential. You know, there's a big world out there. It's not all like, you know, the west of Scotland or the UK. There's a huge world out there of different cultures, different experiences, different languages, and that had a big impact on me. So that certainly helped me to join the dots.
You said that you didn't want to be pigeonholed as the Christian guy in Parliament. How open is Parliament and the whole, not just the MPs, but the whole parliamentary world, the Westminster bubble? How open is that to people of faith and Christians specifically?
Well, look, just to clarify, there are many, many Christians in Parliament and have been always. And so, that sense of being the Christian guy was probably my own or fear of it, is a critique of myself, and my own feelings. Yeah, in terms of it's perfectly possible to have a faith and be open about that in politics. I think it's not easy, and but I think it's getting easier, if I'm honest. I think it's getting easier. I think there, nobody wants you to sort of always be, front and center, because it's not always appropriate or relevant. You just are who you are. But I certainly think there are opportunities just to be open and honest about that. This is your faith, and my sense is getting easier than perhaps it used to be.
Do people come at you with assumptions of the way you're going to vote on certain issues, for example? And is that a stumbling block for people sometimes?
Yes, it is. But the truth of the matter is, I've got close Christian friends here in Parliament who would vote differently from me, or I would vote differently from them on a variety of issues. And it's not as simple as that. I think the most important thing is that you bring your thinking and your whole self to any political issue. And I think we have to be. One thing that I found a bit frustrating, to be honest, about the assisted dying debate, and I was a was and am opposed to the assisted dying bill, very vocal about that throughout the process, both outside the chamber and inside the chamber. If I was to be honest, one thing that frustrated me through that process is that there was sometime a kind of dog whistling of, oh, it's the people with faith that have kind of secret, irrational reasons for holding their position against, assisted dying. And I think that's quite disingenuous, because everybody, whether they have an active faith or not, brings a worldview to their life, to their politics, brings experience of life, deep-seated, gut-based, instinctual responses to things like as profound as assisted dying, that are not exclusively rational or logical. I think we have to be honest, all of us, honest about that. And it shouldn't be that people with a faith, any faith, are pigeonholed as, oh, they are the ones that are exclusively unable to make rational or logical arguments, or for that matter, that people without a faith are not influenced by experiential, gut-based reactions to things, So I think we need to be more intellectually honest about some of this.
Are there for you, David, sort of touchstone scriptures when you're making a big decision or trying to work out how to handle, the nuances and the difficulties of political life? Are there touchstone scriptures that you come to?
There are there, there's loads. That being said, it's not, and I think this is one of the reasons sometimes people that are a bit suspicious of people with a faith think, oh, you might engage with your holy scriptures and think, aha, and draw a direct line to a particular policy and say, well, this is my rationale or justification for holding a position. I think we have to be very, very careful that we don't instrumentalize scripture, that it's not a kind of, I woke up this morning, read this thing, and that's what I should do. It's about a whole life understanding of, what is a human? What is this life that we're part of? And so we have to be very careful that we don't, as I say, instrumentalize scripture. But that caveat aside, yes, I do. You know, the scriptures that have spoken to me at various points throughout my life, as there are for most Christians, and probably loads from other faiths as well. And yeah, I have lots. I mean, the one that I spoke and I mentioned in my maiden speech is Proverbs 31. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. That's a scripture that means a lot to me, and it's a scripture that is I mentioned in my maiden speech so that I could be held account to that.
It's a high scripture to hold yourself account to, isn't it? So, well done for setting a high bar. Let's talk about your role as the special envoy for freedom of religion or belief. That role was handed to you at the end of last year, so you're coming up to your first year in the role. Tell us what it is in a nutshell.
UK Special Envoy for Freedom of Religion or Belief is a role that has been well established over the last decade. I'm the fourth. My predecessor, Fiona Bruce, was the last one under the last Conservative government. So it's a role that has carried on between different governments. It is based within the Foreign Office. My role is to ensure that within UK foreign policy, freedom of religion or belief is taken seriously, advanced around the world. So my focus is very much international. And I work with a team at the Foreign Office and with our embassies or posts around the world to try and make the world a place where persecution on the basis of your religion or belief is diminishing and freedom is increasing.
And there are some brilliant charities, of course, that do that, Open Doors and CSW, for example. So how can the information that they bring, particularly around persecuted Christians, how can that affect the policies that the UK government makes and their relationship with other countries? How much a part can the UK play in helping other countries become safer for people to practice their beliefs, whether they're Christian or not?
I think the UK can play a huge role, and civil society and advocacy organisations like CSW, Open Doors, many others aside, including those coming from other faith positions who I work closely with through something called the Forb Forum here in the UK, have a huge influence over, certainly over me, but more broadly over parliamentarians. You know, if you have the launch of the Open Doors World Watch list every year in, I think, January usually, and you know, they always have huge success in getting parliamentarians there because it's an issue that constituents feel, you know, really passionate about, and lots of parliamentarians. In terms of the UK, I would say that, and do say regularly, you know, I was with, for instance, the UK's ambassador to Poland on Tuesday in Poland. And we were chatting about Forb, and I was saying to her, as I say regularly to those in Foreign Office and outside it, that freedom of religion or belief is really a core value of the United Kingdom. If you think about our history, you think about our democracy now, we're a plural country that through very many ups and downs and mistakes along the way and conflict have come to a settled position that freedom of religion or belief is vital for a flourishing democracy and just for a prosperous and flourishing country. And so when we talk about, or I talk about Forb internationally, it's with humility sharing a core value of what it means to be British and what it means to create the kind of world that we believe in. So there's an element to that which is about a projection of ourselves, but there's also an element that is a kind of soft power is often talked about, being a sense that, you know, how do we influence the world in the direction that we want to see it, and this therefore is at the center of that.
Some of our listeners feel that it's less easy to practice your faith and to express your views as a Christian in the UK now. Do you have any sympathy for that point of view? What would you say to people who feel that?
Well, first of all, that's where I take my envoy hat off, because you know, I don't have a focus on the UK with that role. So this is just me as both a parliamentarian and as a Christian. I don't have a huge amount of sympathy with that view. I think we always have to be mindful and aware and conscious of our own approach to freedom of religion or belief, because it's easy to take things for granted, just as it's easy, by the way, to take our democracy in and of itself for granted, and I'm deeply concerned about that and the engagement with our political process and of the whole country, and it's the overarching arc of travel over the last several decades with that regard. But so we always have to be mindful, always have to be attentive, is there a chilling or whatever? But in my experience, and I don't just mean as a parliamentarian, I mean as a Christian, and I've shared with you, I've been a Christian all my life. I don't feel like there's any less capacity for me to live my faith out, share my faith, be open about my faith in the UK today. So, no, I don't really share that view.
So, how can we make the most of the freedoms that we do have?
I mean, the point of freedom is that everybody gets to decide for themselves, as I say, in my life, I don't feel any constraint or in this country in living out my Christian faith, sharing my faith, being open about it in any way. If there are challenges that come against that, then let's look at them and let's address them. But yeah, I don't feel that constraint.
We're called to pray for our leaders, and we do a lot on Premier Christian Radio. How can we be praying for you in your role and other Christians in Parliament?
Firstly, I'm aware since I came into Parliament that people, Christians do pray for me, including many people I've never met, and I find that profoundly moving and encouraging. And I really would encourage the church in the UK to pray for all parliamentarians of whatever party. I don't mind saying that passionate about the Labour Party as I am. I certainly would have prayed for previous Conservative prime ministers and cabinets because, you do need, like, we're instructed in Scripture to pray for our leaders. And it doesn't say unless, it just says pray for your leaders. And I would ask, certainly for the church to pray for all of our leaders, the prime minister, the cabinet, the opposition. Because at the end of the day, we all need wisdom and courage and humility and strength to do the right things. And if you believe in prayer, and the church does, then those are absolutely things we should be praying for, I think.
Thank you so much. Really lovely talking to you.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.